You have tuned in to Open Mic on CJSF Radio, broadcasting on 90.1 FM from Burnaby Mountain, BC.
Hello everyone, welcome to Open Mic on CJSF 9.1 FM, broadcasting from Burnaby Mountain, snowy Burnaby Mountain, at the traditional unceded territories of the Squamish, Musqueam, Tsleil-Waututh, Coquitlam Nations, and Katsi Nations. We are always grateful to be here, sharing stories and voices from our communities, and I appreciate everyone who has tuned in into Open Mic again. My name is Iago, and today we're going to be diving into some inspiring conversations that were recorded last year. We'll be talking about some intersections of food systems, urban movements, and sustainability, topics that shape how everyone here connects to the community. So the first interview we'll be hearing from is Dr. Tamara Soma. She has an impressive work span from influencing global food systems policies at the United Nations and also tackling some food insecurities here in Vancouver. She has also leading background research at SFU Food Systems Lab, which is a pretty good initiative. We also exploring her insights about reshaping the food landscape. And second, Denis Agar, who will literally move us from the world of public spaces. How to rethink transit systems in Vancouver and how to lead the city's participatory budgeting project. Denis will be sharing some powerful ideas about how to make the spaces more inclusive and equitable. Thank you so much for staying tuned in and follow up with the interviews. So, welcome. Thank you so much for joining us. It's a real pleasure to have you here at CJSF sharing a little bit of your background, of your career. It's so interesting, everything that you've done so far. But I'll give you the opportunity just to introduce yourself, perhaps a little bit of your work, a hobby, anything outside of research that you want to share with everyone.
Wonderful. Thank you so much for inviting me. I'm very pleased to be here today. So just for everyone, my name is Tamara Soma. I'm an associate professor at the School of Resource and Environmental Management at Simon Fraser University. I'm actually calling in today from the Squamish Nation territory of beautiful Gibsons and the Sunshine Coast. And I'm very privileged to be able to work, live, and play here. I've been working at SFU for about 6 years now, and I'm also the co-founder and research director of the Food Systems Lab. And I'm so passionate about the Food Systems Lab, the work that we do, the amazing team that we have, where basically our vision is an equitable and sustainable food system for all. And we hope to make that happen through research, community engaged research, and working with amazing partners on the ground to support their important work on food justice.
Amazing. Thank you so much. And anything outside of like this academic world that you were interested about that you would like to share?
Well, I'm a foodie. I love growing food. I love gardening. I have chickens in my backyard. I love them so much. I can just be happy sitting down, watching my chickens, playing with them. So that's like outside of my academic career. I also love cooking and learning new things about different cultures. So I'm into food professionally because just personally, I'm so passionate about making sure that our food system is sustainable, just personally as well. So it kind of permeates everything that I do. And also on the side, I do a lot of interfaith work because I believe it's so important to promote unity amidst diversity and do a lot of work to foster respect, love, and coexistence. So I also do that on the side, yeah.
Oh my God, that's so cool. I relate so much to watch the chickens play. I used to do the same growing up because I grew up in the countryside of Brazil. Exactly the same. It's so cool. It's so fun.
Yes, definitely. They are fascinating.
And throughout your career, you've mentioned food systems already a few times. It relates a lot to urban planning. Is there anything specific on your experience that like throughout the university, throughout your degrees, that's directed you to have this interest, or is this straight connection that you've just mentioned with your personal interest?
Well, okay, so at the baby level, I mean, I could go very long, but I'm gonna try to shorten it. But from when I was a baby, when I was a toddler, I remember my mom, and she always told me this thing. You know, it's like we call it in my country papata, which is like a saying. Tamara, eat every single grain of rice. If you don't eat it, the rice will cry. And so, you know, in back home in Indonesia, where I'm originally from, rice is such an important part of who we are. It's an important part of our identity. And so remembering that from my mom, like thinking about how rice is not just like something that you eat, but it also comes from the hard work and the labor of the farmer. It's basically your source of survival. And so I've always had this connection where I viewed food more than just calories or just a commodity. And then growing up in Indonesia, seeing a lot of the farmland being kind of paved over for urban development, for malls, for like big houses, and then seeing how the farmers are struggling. And in Indonesia right now, currently is projected that by 2040, if we don't address the situation with farming, farmers would just go extinct. And that's a scary thing to think about when you're thinking about a, you know, a country of 300 million people. Now, when I come to Canada, I realize that we have similar issues in the sense that, you know, the age of farmers in Canada, it's now 56. There's not a lot of kind of transition planning towards the younger generation. It's really hard to get land. But then I'm seeing these patterns all around the world, right? Of like the stigma of being a farmer, how hard it is for them to make things work. And I would just recommend all students in the university, if you can watch the movie Life, Life is Debt. Sorry, Life and Debt. I can't remember, but just put like Life and Debt documentary. It was probably one of the most, it was that documentary that really shaped how I think about the world, the blueprint of colonization and domination. And that just really woke me up to this, like the importance of, you know, understanding how systems work and how we need to, you know, basically decolonize the food system so that people can be food sovereign and decide for their own so they can be self-sufficient.
Perfect. Oh my God, that's so inspirational. And thank you for sharing all of that. I've just moving on a little bit on one thing that you've mentioned that sparkled my curiosity. Is there anything specific that led to the creation of the Food Systems Lab here in Vancouver after you, yeah.
Yeah, of course. So actually, the Food Systems Lab started in 2016, before I was even a professor. I was a PhD student. And what happened was my friend and colleague and it's like friend, colleague, but also my current PhD student, Belinda Lee, who is also a co-founder of the lab. We actually met in a coffee shop. And we were part of this organization called Waste Aid, where we kind of like use our expertise around waste to support, you know, other countries or other associations around the world that might have challenges related to waste management. Anyway, we were talking and we realized that there was a lot of conversation going on, focusing on food waste and food insecurity and saying basically, well, if we have a lot of poor people on the one side, and we have a lot of food waste on the other side, why don't we just connect the two together? And then that will be the solution. Basically, like, that's kind of a win-win. And we were sitting there thinking through it. And we thought, like, you know, this can't be the only solution, because this is not really an equitable solution to have this idea that people who are low income, you know, they should just be fine with like unwanted, unmarketable surplus food, and that this is kind of the end all and be all solution. We just thought like that's not a very dignified way or approach. So Belinda and I decided to apply for funding to start a social innovation lab to bring like diverse people together, diverse food enterprises together, and all of that to identify more just, more equitable solution, something that's more creative and innovative. And that's how it started. And so from 2016, we kept on growing and transforming and evolving from just like focusing on food waste to basically focusing on the food system.
And you've mentioned quickly that that related to your degree and your research at that time, right? I think I've read some about you, and your dissertation focused on food consumption and waste in Indonesia, right?
Yeah.
So is that any way that's influenced your work today here in Canada specifically? Or if you want to share some key findings, it's such interesting research.
Oh, well, thank you so much. You know, the one thing that I want to say is when we think about food waste, often we think about it as like, oh, this is inconvenient. This is not something that you should do, just like, you know, morally, ethically, economically, environmentally. But the thing is, when it comes to developing countries or global South countries like Indonesia, food waste is a ticking time bomb. You know, in 2005, 143 people died because of a methane explosion and that impacted the open dump sites. And this is, you know, it's exacerbated by the mixing of organic waste, the most of it is, you know, which is food waste. And that really created like it just shows that food waste is not something that is just like a side conversation, but it's like a really serious matter, especially in Indonesia, where sometimes many of the waste pickers are collecting the leftovers and the remnants of unwanted food for their own food consumption, you know, and many of these waste pickers are actually children, which is again something really harrowing. In Indonesia, what I've been, you know, some of the key findings from my research is that people are changing from a buy today, eat today food practice to like stocking up at the grocery store. And I think that, you know, kind of mimics what we have here in like global north and Western countries. So, you know, the small, they used to buy in small amounts. They used to cook it, eat it on the same day, and then they used to shop again because there's like the whole infrastructure, like the wet markets and then the mobile vendors that come around your neighborhood with a cart or something. But that's not, you know, but a lot of that is kind of like on the decline because of urban development and various pressures from supermarkets, and you know this kind of like competition in prices. And it's not really competition in a fair way. It's like a price war in a way where supermarkets really reduce their price and then gather and then basically like the wet markets decline. And then once the wet markets are all shut down, that's when they can jack up the price. I mean, this price war is very common in many, many places. So there's that one particular case, a particular, you know, important information is that we need diverse infrastructure. If we don't have diverse infrastructure, we're kind of like at the whim and the mercy of the major multinational supermarkets and the prices that they put, and then the kind of things that they put, like in terms of what they curate. In my research, I talk a lot about the importance of preserving traditional food infrastructures, like the traditional markets, the mobile vegetable vendors, and all of that, because it is so critical to enabling people to do that kind of like small scale consumption and not pushing on stocking up.
So just confirming, what I'm hearing is one of the most the ways to address food waste in one of the most important ways to address the food waste and is focusing on community-based projects and like your own community developments are surrounding food systems, right?
I mean, that's definitely one of them. I think that what's also important is that, for example, in the case of Indonesia, is that different incomes purchase differently. And at the moment, right now, when it comes to the upper income communities, their consumption patterns is very much similar to Western consumption with the big shop once a week. And then also after they shop, they might also buy other foods and then they forget it. In the supermarket, they do a lot of buy one, get one free options and those types of things to nudge people to buy more than what they need. And then the one thing that I think is interesting is I actually look at how different people shop. And in the supermarkets, there's this tendency for people to like say they want meat and then they get the meat, they put it in their grocery cart, but then they change their mind. And then what they would do is they wouldn't take the meat back to the meat place. They would just like leave it somewhere because there is this kind of like, we call it distancing. There's this kind of like disconnect. There is no like personal investment in like the people there or the staff there. And same with the food that they have, you know, that they just kind of like, oh, I changed my mind. I'm just going to leave it there. And then that goes to waste, which you will never see in a traditional market. You will never see someone going to a vendor, taking their food, and then going and walking around and then deciding they don't want it and then just plopping it somewhere. So that direct connection is so important, and that's lost in the supermarket context. So we need to kind of bring that back, because what we're seeing right now is we're automating everything, right? We don't even need clerks anymore, because we can just like go in the supermarket and go to those self-checkout, and we never even have to meet, like talk to anyone.
And it's all of this knowledge, all of this expertise that led you to your beautiful and appointment to the HLPEFSN. Oh, that was hard to say. So I really, from before and from now even most, I really admire your work. So congratulations.
Thank you.
And for everyone, do you mind sharing a little bit of what this role involves? What is this appointment and what issues you're focusing on the report?
Yeah, that's great. So, you know, it's interesting because ever since I was like a PhD student, I've always followed the work of the high level panel of experts on food security and nutrition. So HLPEFSN of the FAO, United Nations. And they basically commission important reports that are seminal to the field, everything from the weaponization of food to urban and peri-urban resiliency to youth engagement in agriculture. And so basically the HLPEFSN committee put out a call to commission a report on building resilient food systems, which is so important in light of everything that's happened from COVID to climate change issues to wars. And so through a competitive process, like people from all around the world applying, they basically selected several of us, including myself, and I'm very honored and humbled to be selected to be part of the team. And so we are in the process of building this report together. I have colleagues from Ghana, from Mexico, from Portugal, from all around the world, and we are using all of our interdisciplinary expertise together to identify pathways and recommendations for global food system resiliency. So it's a tough act, you know, it's a tough like process, but I think we have such an amazing team, and I hope we'll do a very good job.
And I just want to build up a little bit. You've explained the importance of resilience really quickly, but I want to dive into it a little bit more, just because understanding it, as you said, is maybe one of the keys to solving these issues in the future, at least surrounding the policy recommendations themselves. So would you mind like talking a little bit more about why resilience is a central theme to this report, and what does it mean in the context of food systems?
Well, at the moment right now, we have a food system that is not resilient. So anytime that there's a shock, there are stressors, there are so many problems that come. For example, when COVID happened, what we saw immediately was that supermarkets shelves were bare, and people were lining up and they weren't able to get food. And the people that were able to get food were people that had more resources, had a car, maybe had like an extra refrigerator so they could stock up. And when we think about resiliency, we need to think about, well, resiliency is not just about something bouncing back to its original state, but how can we think about a food system that, you know, amid shocks and stressors can function and can thrive and can support an equitable system for everyone, especially those who are currently most vulnerable. So the reason why resiliency is so important, especially, and I will say, right, the industrial dominant food system right now is quite resilient, right? So because it's everywhere. When you think about what options we're given in the supermarket or anywhere else, it's usually dominant corporate, food choices. So whereas like the smaller farmers, the home businesses, like all of those kind of things, you don't really get exposed to it. So they're pervasive. But the thing is, it comes with a cost. Real, like the real and true cost of like cheap food is that you have poor health, you have poor environmental health, and also you have what is called a two-tier food system, where some people can choose and can buy food that they want, and then the other people are just kind of left with like unwanted food or charity option. So that's not resilient, obviously. And so when we think about resiliency in the work that we are doing, and of course, you know, we're in the draft stages right now, and then this report will actually go through a consultation phase internationally. And so I think, you know, for students especially, it's important for you to check out the draft report, you know, provide feedback, give recommendations, tell us like what are we missing in the conversation. And so when we think of the resiliency that we want to pursue and promote, we want to think about ecological resiliency, economic resiliency, social resiliency, and a resiliency that makes sure that those who are vulnerable get access to culturally appropriate, nutritious, healthy, and environmentally sustainable food.
Perfect. And
yeah,
just a little bit from that, do you have any specific policies that come to mind that are maybe the most effective you've seen so far to address just the both the resilience problem and also maybe the food waste at a local level?
Yeah, so I mean, personally and from my own research, and so not talking about the report per se, because I think that that whole piece around the recommendation is currently being developed. So I have seen firsthand amazing examples of food systems resiliency from many Indigenous communities and partners who are working on, for example, integrating land-based learning and education within their schools, like teaching children how to grow their own food, how to hunt, how to fish, how to process that food. I mean, they become so self-sufficient and so capable and so empowered that if they were to like go in the forest, they would be able to survive. They would have no problem. And one thing that's also important is that an important piece of resiliency is also knowledge and building that knowledge. And increasingly, for especially the urban consumers, most of us don't even know where our food comes from, how, like, you know, what are the nutrients, you know, how it's grown and everything like that. So, you know, we can go out and we might not know that there's all these edible foods around us, and we would just think they're weeds, you know. So for me as a professor, the education piece is so important. And I've seen examples in Haida Gwaii with the Haida Gwaii Local Food Committee, and in so many other places where they're instilling the seeds of food resiliency from a very early age. And I think that's the way to go.
That's so cool. And that's particularly interesting for me, because I remember following up with a project slash course that was available in my country, because there we have this bioma which is called Cerrado in Brazil, and it's a really big, most cities or a big percentage of them are located within this territory, this biome, and mostly no one understands how to use the food from this biome to build up on their own culinary, and how to extract the nutrients, basically exploring where you live. And it was really interesting. I didn't have the chance to take part, but it's they brought up everyone to learn how to use the local plants to cook. So it was so beautiful. I still want to take the opportunity.
I actually want to mention, since you mentioned Brazil, probably another one of the most positive example of resiliency is from Belo Horizonte in Brazil. And so in Belo Horizonte in Brazil, basically the municipality had dedicated 2% of the budget of the municipal budget to food policy. And so they have something called like the People's Market. They have like they support local farmers by allowing them to, it's like, it's not just a farmer's market, because what they do is the city subsidizes healthy food so that more people can access it, which is very important. But also in these like people's market and people's restaurant, what happens is, you know, it's a restaurant that anyone can go to that is very affordable, accessible, healthy, all from local food, so that there's no stigma, right? So it's not just like, oh, you're going there because you're poor and you don't have money. No, like you can be rich, you can be poor, you can be at any level, and anyone can go there and eat together. So Belo Horizonte has been kind of like the top when it comes to like school food, people's market, people's restaurant, and the municipal and government policy commitment to food
That's so interesting to learn. I actually have been to the Foods restaurant. They have another it's another name in São Paulo, but it's basically a São Paulo state program, and the food is so good. The food is crazy good, and they buy all from local markets and farmers, as you said. It's crazy. It's a really great policy. Thank you for mentioning it.
Yeah, it's from your very own home country.
Yes. And maybe just to wrap it up and go a little bit for the listeners. If people want to start making a difference here, how can they contribute to sustainability in their communities, maybe helping address Vancouver's local problems? What comes to mind?
Okay, if you're thinking about Vancouver, so for me, I always immediately when I go to a different city or a different place, I start kind of identifying, creating kind of like a list of all of the food organizations, the people that are doing important work on the ground, and I find the ones that I would like to contribute or get involved with, because that's where I learn, that's where I make my network, that's where I can see, how to support community organizations that are doing important work. And so in Vancouver, there's a Vancouver Food Justice Coalition. They are doing very, very important work to kind of identify ways that provide dignified food access for communities, regardless of who you are, where you're from in the city. And there's also the Vancouver Food Policy Council, so that's also amazing. But for me, now that I live in the Sunshine Coast, I'm involved, and I support this organization called the One Straw Society. They're like a food hub. They do a lot of amazing work, like providing community-supported agriculture, Good Food Box. They have a little tiny farm and a repair li like a sorry, not a repair a tool library that farmers can use to share different farming tools, so that they don't have to worry about going in debt, right, to buy these expensive tools. I mean, we need to support more sharing, food sharing, food commons, food forests. There's this book called Cytopia by Carolyn Steele, and it's this idea of a place that just supports food, everywhere. So I mean, we can really envision a better world. Like right now, what we have, I think we can do a much better job.
Thank you so much. Thank you so much for all you've brought us here. I think it's a great opportunity to understand more about what's happening around us, to understand how not necessarily food banks are the solution, at least not on a long-term policy and understanding of how food systems work. Thank you so much for being here.
You're welcome. You're welcome. Thank you so much, Iago.
Hello, thank you for staying tuned in into Open Mic at CJSF 9.1 FM. My name is Iago. I'm the producer of this series of podcast episodes. And you have just heard me in an interview with Tamara Soma about her food systems, about her new work with the UN, about innovative policies around food banks in Vancouver. And following up is my interview with Danny Zagar about transit in Vancouver, his participation in the participatory budgeting, and much more.
The Canadian Human Trafficking Hotline is now live to help victims and survivors get vital social and emergency services. If you need help or want to help stop human trafficking, call 1-833-900-1010.
Indulge yourself in the cultural and folklore traditions of Italy on Il Sole Italiano every Sunday from 2 to 4 p.m.
Eravamo ancora fanciulli ogni sera su quel prato.
Dennis, welcome to the show.
Hi, thanks for having me.
Of course, thank you so much. So, as always, we like to talk here about things that feel are hard, that feel it's with passion, and I see that you're so passionate about transit. So I want to know where that comes from. Not everyone has such a peculiar interest.
Yeah, well, I think it started in, even when I was a teenager, it was around the time when we were really starting to learn about climate change and how bad it was going to be. And I went into university and I just kind of got deeper and deeper into climate change to the point where I switched over into urban planning as my major, because I realized that that was probably the number one thing that we can do in the West to reduce our climate emissions, is to change the way we design our cities. And I kind of followed that line of logic and reasoning, and to the point where, you know, cars in, you know, most parts of urban North America, cars are the number one source of greenhouse gas emissions. And that we don't need, you know, there are all these other